This podcast is rated S for science and also for spoilers and swearing. There's going to be swearing.
Something is killing these people and sucking them dry.
Run! It's a stampede!
If you had spoken such insolence to Jabba, he'd have fed you to his menagerie.
Please, speak freely.
Welcome, everybody, back to another episode of Cinematic Animalia, your weekly foray into the biology of movie monsters. Today, we are looking at the first episode of The Book of Boba Fett, the latest entry into an ever-expanding and, much like our own, hopefully at some point soon, retracting Star Wars universe. We'll go over some news, as always, tell you a bit about the season, our thoughts, and then we'll get stuck into the science that this show brings up, including reptomammalians and their real-life Earth analogues, desert adaptations, and how you might actually get a desert planet. And you can't see, but I'm doing air quotes as I say planet. As always, the show will be broken up into a few different segments. We'll have time codes below, so skip ahead to the bits you're looking for. But before we get stuck in, my name is Sam Perrin. I'm a freshwater / invasive ecologist and climate data analyst based in Trondheim, Norway. I think this is the episode where being a freshwater ecologist is the most useless. I also run the website Ecology for the Masses alongside absentee host Adam Harsick and absentee Baroness Her Ladyship Libby Young, who does not get a special accent because she's not here. Neither is Adam, even though I'd worked on my Tamura Morrison accent all week. It's the best one we've got so far, but I'm not doing it.
Put it in the tank.
They were going to be here. What happened, Dave? Do you know?
So, I mean, from what I understand, as we know, a couple of weeks ago when Adam got himself trapped in the desert and had to be rescued, that Adam has developed environmental Stockholm syndrome. He felt the desert calling to him, similar to Dune. Middle of the night, got up, and he's wandered into the desert again, and Libby has had to go to try and bring him back in. Screaming and crying the entire time, I imagine. I don't think she has a helicopter, but I'm kind of hoping that she does.
For a man who's lived in Sweden, he should know that anything that has Stockholm involved in it is bad juju and should be avoided rigorously. I've gone so native as a Norwegian, just constantly shitting on everything Swedish.
Just going after them.
Yeah. Before we get into news, so I was challenged last week when I said that there were other good late 90s and early 2000s sci-fi monster alien films.
Haven't let this go.
I was challenged to come up with five. And I said I would be back this week, and I have a list of eight here, which Adam and Libby have seen, and they have signed off on, definitely. I am not making this up for the first time now, and they agree with me that all of these films are better than Pitch Black.
Let's hear them.
So, number one, Independence Day.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I should actually say, I don't think all of these films are better than Pitch Black, but I would recommend watching these films rather than watching Pitch Black.
Okay.
Yeah. Mars Attacks, as Libby put forward last week.
Okay.
Starship Troopers as well.
Yeah, good one.
I would even put Alien versus Predator on there.
Oh, you put it above Pitch Black?
I would put it above Pitch Black. Oh. It's got aliens, it's got predators, it's got, you know, it's got nice grisly deaths.
Fighting in a snow
fortress. It's absolute trash, but I really like it. Okay. I feel like that's the sort of thing that is comparable to how Libby sees Pitch Black. I see Alien versus Predator.
Okay.
Like, I go back, and I know it's formulaic and bad, but I still really enjoy it. Species.
Okay, yeah.
Have you ever seen Species? Yes. That is my early teenage boy nostalgia kicking in.
I'd still recommend Pitch Black over it, but continue.
Deep Rising.
Okay, yeah.
Sphere.
Okay, I actually have a soft spot for Sphere, so yes.
I do too, yeah. Okay. I really like that. Event Horizon?
Yeah. I mean, I love Event Horizon.
And I think you'll really enjoy this one, Mimic.
Oh, I love Mimic.
Yeah.
I love Mimic.
I don't know if all eight were better than Pitch Black, and Libby is probably screaming right now. Although, like I said, Libby did sign off on all of these, so I don't know why she would be screaming. But yeah, I think there's probably five in there that give it a run for its money anyway.
Yeah, we'll have to do Mimic at some point.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. Okay, news this week.
Yeah, so Norway's been making some changes to the way that water flows, Sam?
Yeah, so this was actually a big motivator for my PhD. The fact that when you introduce a dam, which, you know, has happened in a lot of places across the world, and it's a huge source of clean power in Norway, you fuck up river systems entirely.
Yeah.
So you change flow regimes, you can potentially destroy floodplains, and you block off migration routes for a lot of fish species that really need it. The interesting thing that's happening now, though, is that, and this isn't so much a problem in Norway because the topography is so steep. You get massive, like, kind of steep fjords, very variable, like, altitudes, mm-hmm. which makes it harder for fish to migrate upstream in a lot of cases. But the introduction of lots of invasive species has meant that in a lot of scenarios, the only thing keeping these species out is a dam. So again, not so much a problem in Norway, but in the Great Lakes, for instance, this is a huge issue. So for instance, the sea lamprey in the Great Lakes in Canada and the USA, they are a huge threat to lake trout populations. Yep. And they actually resulted in the crash of one of that area's biggest fisheries in the 50s and 60s. They've been extensively treated with a lampricide, so something that kills lampreys. But a lot of areas where they are still potentially going to be a problem are protected by dams. And there's some people who want to knock these dams down because they allow, in this case, the walleye to move around.
Yep.
And in Norway, they allow the salmon migration routes to open up again. But they're worried that the sea lamprey, or in Norway, some parts of Norway, they're worried that pink salmon, humpback salmon, which are an invasive species, are going to get in.
Mm.
I think in most cases, it's probably better just to restore the natural migration routes and knock down the dams. But it's a big trade-off. And this is we always talk about the fact that one of the key words in ecology is compromise. We can't afford to maintain everything. Humans have messed up ecosystems to the point that even sometimes, you know, good things like reintroducing species do more damage than good. Sometimes. I think we should be striving to help out where we've messed up, but yeah.
But no, I mean, reading that article and talking about the 1.2 million in-stream barriers in Europe causing a freshwater fish drop in Europe of around 90% between 1970 and 2016. 90? But I do love Norway tearing down some of these dams and all of the images that were sent to us as well. I love that it's just these construction crews out in the middle of winter with these like frozen water behind them, and they look totally at home. All the guys are like smiling and they're like working away, and I'm like, I'm not that tough.
But yeah, this is a massive trend that's sweeping across Europe now, dam removal.
Cool.
Which, another one of these trade-offs is, like I said, it provides a lot of clean hydropower.
Now I'm about to take you through a fully functioning power plant. So please, no one wander off the dam tour. And please take all the dam pictures you want. Now, are there any dam questions?
So, this week we looked at the Book of Boba Fett, Episode 1. For anybody who thinks that's not comprehensive enough, we will circle back around and have another look at this when the series is over.
Yeah.
But the Book of Boba Fett is a deep dive into one of the original Star Wars trilogy's most overrated characters in an attempt to discover whether or not he is, in fact, just an inept wanker or the badass that legions of sweaty, pimple-faced teenagers who are now 40-something basement dwellers make him out to be. Our titular character is joined by all-around badass and critically underrated Ming-Na Wen.
Yeah.
As we muddle through the number one trope that TV and movie directors still have not written their way out of, constant fucking flashbacks.
Yeah.
Showmen include traces of beheadings, acute eczema, and putting on a New Zealand accent for hours after viewing. So, Dave, what did you like about this?
I love the aesthetic. In terms of, and I like this. I really love the flying by the seat of his pants. That, you know, he's not this super well organized. He's got four different plans. He's got, you know, all these squads and extra backups. I did watch all the first three episodes, and each episode is him just kind of muddling along, and someone tries to kill or attack him, and he like barely escapes, and he's like, oh, I need to hire somebody else to try and cover this, or like, crap, this part of the empire is like falling apart. And I love that. Like the first couple of Star Wars, there was never any big organization or anything like that. The first one starts off with, we found a hole in the big death machine. We need someone to fly along the surface of this while guns shoot at it and shoot something into that hole.
Then the second one is just them trying to replace a lost part for the entire movie.
Yeah, I
agree 100%. This feels very much like old school Star Wars. I'm not a huge Star Wars nerd by any means. I really like new ones, the first two, that is. But this feels this and The Mandalorian feels a lot more like old school Star Wars. And as you said, they captured the aesthetic perfectly, I feel like. I also really like seeing Ming-Na Wen and stuff. I think she's great. I think she deserves to be in more stuff. And this had really great monsters. I only watched the first episode, but it had two really interesting and fun monsters in there. And look, Star Wars always has great monsters. They've always had them right from the first Star Wars movie. They've just been fantastic. So,
and I love how much Temuera Morrison loves playing this character. He's come out and he's like, yeah, I will play whatever clone that you want me to play. I'm happy to play Rex. Like, he's already thrown in his hat and he's like, you need me to play like other clones? I'm totally down for that.
Yeah. I'll play my dad again. I'll go back and play Django.
He'll play Django. I mean, it'd be hard without a head, but you know.
Temuera Morrison, he'll go the extra mile. He'll method act for that sort of thing.
I also just love any time he takes any injury, he's just like back into the back to tank.
Yeah. Oh, Bacta looks gross, though. Just a goopy kind of, not quite slimy, but also just not quite viscous enough. Yeah, no. I like it. Yeah. What don't we like about this, speaking of Bacta tanks?
Going through the first three episodes, it is a little bit slow. It's got a little bit of like a drag to like move its way along from character to character. It also, I mean, and this is just a personal story criticism, and I'm probably completely wrong in this. I don't find that he's nasty enough or talented enough to earn the reputation so far, that oftentimes he gets into these fights and he gets like the crap kicked out of him by someone. And then right afterward, he just completely apologizes to them and like takes them into his team. And I like that his assassin is standing off to the side every time. And she's like, you know, maybe you should torture or kill or do some stuff. And he's like, nah, it'll probably be fine. Like, yeah, I don't have to inspire.
He's fear. So mild mannered.
Yeah. Yeah. I both love and hate that.
Yeah. I just felt this was very, very blur. Like I said, I've only watched the first episode, so this might change as the season goes on, but I didn't find it very engaging.
First scene out of the Sarlacc pit is great, though.
Yes, I enjoyed that, but the rest of the show are just, yeah, and like I said, I find the constant flashbacks.
Yeah, episode two, there's a lot of episode three, we're starting to get back to just living in the present.
Okay, good, because yeah, the flashback trope is very frustrating. Yes. I waded through six seasons of Arrow, and we finally got to the sixth season because he'd been going, you know, 1 year at a time, and he'd been gone for 5 years. So we got to season six and I was like, okay, great, no more flashbacks. But they somehow managed to manufacture more flashbacks.
They are sometimes enjoyable. He has a water trader he's dealing with at some point, and the water trader's like, yeah, water's really important on this desert planet. And he throws in this like the most entitled line of the show, which is, well, the planet that I grew up on is covered in water. And the water trader's like, well, that's fucking good for you. Yeah. You're here now.
Wet privilege.
Yeah.
Maybe you should check your privilege.
I just meant that eating too much processed food is a big factor in weight gain, and I...
What? Big people shouldn't be proud of who they are.
No, of course not. I mean, ask your doctor and he will tell you.
He? Why would you assume the doctor is he? Is it because you assume a woman can't be a doctor?
Trivia.
The show really hasn't been running all that long to have developed a huge amount of trivia following, but obviously just going through a couple of points, like I was super excited to see Jon Favreau back here as a producer on the show. He just loves Star Wars, and having this giant nerd that plops himself, we've talked before about how refreshing it is to see Henry Cavill playing The Witcher and how it's the best part because he's just like, no, I want it this way and I want it this way. Having like a presence like that before, it's fantastic. I love that this show, and I hadn't realized it until I got reading through, takes place in the exact same time as The Mandalorian. So I get to enjoy the fact that while Boba Fett is running around, The Mandalorian is also running around doing his thing on various parts of the universe at the same time.
Yeah.
And I mean, obviously anyone who's watching this show, I love we're back on Tatooine. I do love that this show is coming back to its roots And I always
don't you get sick of the same fucking planet constantly?
Tatooine. I love those little shack buildings, and I will never tire of a cantina. And then just in terms of point of trivia, which I hadn't realized, the Rodian, the alien who's tied up next to him in the very first episode, who totally betrays him to just be like, he's trying to escape. And you're like, you're going to die later, which, spoiler alert, gets stomped into the ground. So good on that.
Yeah, I was expecting like a Goro / King Shark style rip apart in two, but then I remember this is a PG show and they can't do that.
I'm fine with him getting stomped into the sand. So he is he's played by Sam Witwer, who had previously voiced Darth Maul for the Star Wars series. So for the Clone Wars, Star Wars Rebels, and for the Battlefront games. So it was just cool to see them like bringing back. And he's also done work in Solo, A Star Wars Story, as well as in Star Wars, The Force Unleashed. So hearing his voice back in the series and seeing that kind of keeping him in the Star Wars universe, super cool.
I have one last bit of trivia that I think will blow everyone's mind. What film do you think that Boba Fett made his debut in?
He was in New Hope, wasn't he, very briefly?
Nope.
Oh, so he started in Empire Strikes Back then?
Nope.
Oh, dear God, he didn't start in the Christmas special, did he?
He starred in the Star Wars Holiday Special.
Oh.
That was his debut appearance.
Oh, God.
Yep. I'm just reading from a Den of Geek article here. One of the most memorable sections of the Wookiee-centric holiday special is the animated segment where Boba Fett appeared wielding a tuning fork-like rifle, now the Amban Phase Pulse Blaster, and riding a dinosaurian sea creature.
Oh, God, and they referenced that in the show, because at one point, spoiler alert for anyone who hasn't got to it, Boba says that he wants to learn to ride a Rancor. And they're like, have you ever ridden a large organism before? And he says, I've ridden something larger than a Rancor. And that is definitely a callback to that. Oh, God.
Reference to the holiday special. Oh. Wonderful. That's what you need in terms of fan service, right?
Yeah, everybody wants to remember the holiday special.
We've come in search of a ship that crashed near here.
Maybe I can help you. I am Boba Fett. The ship you seek is nearby.
So, before we get stuck into the science, if you have any thoughts or questions, as always, you can find Adam and I on Twitter. I am at Big Dr. Fishboy. Adam is at Harsic Adam. If you want to get in touch with the podcast, visit our website, cinematicaanimalia.com, or email us at cinematica.animalia@gmail.com. If you want to read Libby's work, you can visit shortstorysoup.substack.com. Sign up for fortnightly emails with new stories. And if you want to hear about some of the more hardcore science that Adam, myself, and a huge team of writers write about, you can check out ecologyforthemasses.com. Particularly this week, you should check it out, anybody who enjoys Cinematica Animalia, because our former guest, Danielle Crowley, has put up a fantastic piece on why Don't Look Up is not the perfect climate change movie, but Lord of the Rings is. And I highly recommend checking it out. Ooh. It will have been up for a couple of days by this time. We have briefly mentioned this before in other episodes, but The Field Guide to Star Wars, which was a book written in the early 2000s, which provides a somewhat biological look at the creatures we see across the different Star Wars planets, talked a lot about what have been termed reptomammals. So, reptile-like mammals. And we've seen this a lot in the different Star Wars movies. For instance, we saw the large woolly rhino that looks essentially exactly like an Elasmotherium in the first episode of The Mandalorian. Mm-hmm. But it had an egg, had a very hairy, gross egg, but it was definitely laying an egg. In this episode, we see the opposite. We see two very reptilian-looking, at least superficially reptilian-looking creatures that have a lot of characteristics about their body that are more similar to what we would actually find in mammals. So, for instance, the Mastiff, who is the dog. I mean, obviously he's not a dog, but he's a dog. He's a good boy. He makes some yelping noises, and he's, standing guard. It's the Star Wars version of a dog for the Sand People anyway. So I'm just going to call him the dog for the remainder of the episode. Looks very reptilian. Scales.
Yep.
Even the eyes look somewhat reptilian. The snout is somewhat crocodilian as well, kind of a cross between a gharial and an alligator.
Yep.
But the legs are pretty much under the body,
yeah,
which is a feature of mammals. It allows us a lot more mobility. We don't have to move in short bursts. Gives us a lot more stamina.
Yep.
And it seems to, and I am stretching a bit here, I paused a couple of times, I couldn't get a good look, but it seems to have specialized teeth. So the teeth change as they go further back in the jaw, which is, again, a feature of mammals, not just having the same teeth the whole way down. Yeah, specialized teeth for doing different things. Tearing, chewing, that sort of thing. And the other one as well, Frog Centaur Man. I don't know what the name of that species is, but you all know what I'm talking about. Really cool design. Again, I thought it was fantastic. I thought the mobility was really cool as well, the way it walked around. It kind of gives an answer to a lot of the questions that we have about centaurs or even the creature that we looked at in the ritual, right? How does a species like this need to have two rib cages? And the answer here is no. It's just kind of one elongated vertebra moving along. There's obviously, you know, changes that have to be made to fit in another pair of arms. But I thought it was a really cool take on that sort of, you know, six-limbed organism.
Yes.
Yeah. But again, when it stands up and when it moves along, it's got its legs further under its body.
Yeah.
And I couldn't really tell on this one, but it seems to have specialized teeth. And also, it seems to have some requirement to thermoregulate. Because it's not basking out in the sun or anything like that. It's hiding under the ground and, you know, trying to keep cool, I assume. And Dave's going to talk a little bit more about that sort of stuff later. So you've got kind of a mix between a reptile and a mammal in both of these situations. And we did have analogues for that on this planet a long time ago. So people kind of think of mammals as, I wouldn't say a recent organism, but a more modern group of species than dinosaurs or reptiles. People often talk about the age of the dinosaurs. However, the roots of mammals go much further back than dinosaurs themselves. Back before, you know, the periods that we think about as the age of the dinosaurs, the Jurassic, the Triassic, the Cretaceous, we had what was called the Permian. Yeah, so the Permian was the period before those three. And at the start of the Permian, you had what's called amniotes, which are lizard-like or reptile-like creatures.
Okay.
The amniotes split off into two groups. The sauropsids, which went on to become dinosaurs, all sorts of reptiles, and eventually birds.
Mm-hmm.
And the other group that split off was the synapsids. Now, the synapsids would go on to, I mean, we are technically synapsids. In the same sense that birds are reptiles, just so Adam hears those magical three words.
He loves that.
Yeah. We are synapsids. So the synapsids are what's generally referred to not as true mammals, but as stem mammals. So they're kind of the group that would go on to become mammals.
Mm-hmm.
And in the early days, back before the Permian extinction, they were quite common and they were everywhere. Their legs moved further under the body, like you see with the two species we have today. Hmm. But a lot of them still laid eggs. Some of them are still quite scaly, although the cynodonts did go, which again, we are technically a part of, the cynodonts did go on to grow hair. And a lot of these species continued laying eggs even when they grew hair and persisted throughout the entire Triassic, Cretaceous, and Jurassic periods. Just small and undetected. We often focus on the fact that the age of the dinosaurs were those three periods, but mammals were there as well the entire time.
Cool.
They were just generally very small, and they don't get focused on as much because who's going to, you know, focus on a tiny little cynodont when you've got a Brachiosaurus skeleton to uncover and talk about? Jurassic Park has probably, you know, had a lot to do with this sort of stuff as well. One of the better known synapsids that people might know is the Dimetrodon.
Oh, yep. Okay, yes.
And this I found really interesting because if you look at the Dimetrodon, it's got a massive sail on its back. And that's why I think the dog in this series is really cool, because what if they weren't sails? What if they were spikes or something like that? I think it's a really cool kind of take. I'm sure the bone structure is different. And I'm sure that there's some massive fuck up that I'm making, but I think that is a really cool take on, you know, Dimetrodon sails. And a lot of these synapsids had similar structures on their back.
Cool.
There were some real fucking weirdos in there as well. One thing that I really wanted to show Libby, because she's always banging on about Godzilla's stupid pinhead.
Sure.
There is a species of synapsid called the Cotylorhynchus. Hang on, it's a pain in the ass to spell, so I'm just going to copy an image into the chat.
Oh!
The most pin-headed animal I've ever seen in my life, right? Just this enormous fat body with this tiny little head at the end.
For our listeners, it looks like a sort of seal body, but with a tiny, like, mouse's head attached to it. Or, like, if you did a Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, but you only shrunk part of the animal.
Yeah. Cotylorhynchus. If you want to look it up, just type in Cotylor, and there will be no other search results with a different spelling. Yeah. So, there were some real bloody weirdos in this group. They're not sure as to whether or not these were capable of thermoregulation. There's some debate as to whether that's the case. So, potentially, these would have been basking, but I don't know.
And I'm reading something right now that says that they went extinct because they couldn't find hats that could fit them to protect themselves from the sun with heads like that. Is that true?
Potentially.
Okay, cool.
Potentially.
Yeah. All right, cool. I didn't think BuzzFeed would lie to me, so that's good.
Yeah. Fashion was, a big thing before the dinosaurs came along.
They just got bullied to death. Just people blew up their Instagram profiles. Okay, cool.
The Cotylorhynchus, I think, would have definitely been bullied to death. Just rocks up to school every day. Hey, fucking pinhead, what's going on? There's no way that guy's having a good life or procreating at any point. But they did have... They were the ones who started to develop specialized teeth, the synapses. And they would have done very well in the desert, because if you can lay eggs, you're likely to do better in the desert, because your kids aren't going to desiccate and need water. They're going to hatch out of eggs, eggs that are filled with water. And they started to flourish once, they turned into mammals, and then the mammals started to flourish once the dinosaurs once the dinosaurs died out. But many are thought to, like I said, have retained scaly skin whilst taking on more mammal-like features.
Cool.
So I think that that's what we have here. We don't have, we've just got a species that has evolved in a similar fashion.
Yeah.
You've had reptiles, and they've just developed more mammalian characteristics, but they haven't taken on all of those characteristics. Some of them have, for instance, the curl-headed, the big things with the big ram horns.
Banthas.
Yeah, the banthas, for instance. Yeah, they've got big ram horns, curly ram horns, and they've got massive furry coats, but they've also got tails, and they've got weird reptilian-like faces as well. Yeah.
We don't see that much of the face, and the only part of the face that we see that I really love, they've got really tough and hardened lips that you need in the desert to conserve water, as well as chew on most of the things there that are also similarly tough and hardened spined.
So yeah, that's what I think we've got here. But, of course, these things are going to need more desert adaptations than just...
an evolutionary history. Yeah, so I mean, I focused most of my effort. Most of these creatures are showing a lot of these features. But I'm going to try to focus on the... Do we have a good name for the six-armed creature?
Frog Centaur Man.
Frog Centaur Man. Okay, cool. So the Frog Centaur Man that's seen in the very first episode to...
Actually, it's more of a gecko head, isn't it?
Yeah. It's a gecko centaur man?
Gecko head centaur man.
Gecko head centaur man. The creature that basically is hiding underneath the sun or the sand and ends up attacking them, pulling and finally squashing that annoying Rhodesian, and then gets killed by Boba Fett, and they bring the head back, which finally brings him into the tribe, as it were. It actually has a lot of features of desert adaptations that we see within desert species. So, for example, burrowing. So burrowing is a common feature that's used by a number of different species as a adaptation to basically present yourself underneath the ground and to keep yourself away from the hot heat during the day and then to come back out at night and be active. A lot of desert reptile species do this. They're still able to keep warm enough under the sand that they're fine without getting to that sort of sweltering, damaging heat perspective. As well as its reduced metabolic activity, maybe not a true hibernation, but being in a reduced state, which would explain why they were above this thing for so long digging, and it didn't do shit up until they started to get close enough that they actually revealed a hand, and then the Rhodesian starts messing with the hand, which causes this thing to be like, oh, cool. Like, if the snack's going to come to me, then yeah, I'll eat you.
Yeah.
Hard, scaly skin. Sam's kind of already got into this a little bit, but the whole idea behind that thickened, keratinized skin layer is just it holds the water in. the most valuable part that you've got to keep. Now, other adaptations that we see with the desert-dwelling species. So a number of these lizards that actually burrow and they work themselves underneath the ground, they need some changes. So they've actually lost any external ear openings in most of these lizard and reptile species to stop sand from going into their ears. I don't think this thing can hear or not hear well, because Boba Fett fucking sneaks up behind this thing with chains jangling off him, and it's still completely focused on everything else. And it seems like if you're not inside its visual field, it's not catching you. And I didn't see any ears on it.
No. Yeah, I've got a close-up shot of Boba Fett strangling in here, and I can't see any ears either.
Nope. Now, it also has a lot of the other features that we look for in burrowing species. They usually have a wedge-shaped head. They've got nasal valves that are in place to lock things off. They've got ringed eyelids, and they've got fine body scales so that they can sort of burrow easily and come back up. It looks like the scales on this thing are pretty fine. They're pretty locked together. I don't see it creating a lot of resistance when it's sort of underneath the sand. They oftentimes will as well. They actually take on a... Here we go. So they will often have small eyes, narrow heads, countersunk lower jaws, and very smooth scales that are important for swimming and breathing in the sand. Because you've got...
It's got some of them.
Yeah. Yeah. But I bet it has a nasal valve, and I bet it's got a modified third eyelid that it can drop up in place to protect itself from sand movement.
Yeah. When it has eyes that are that large, you'd have to.
Now, I did stumble across, because, I mean, there's a number of other desert adaptations we see within this. It's got large feet, which I hadn't realized is a really important part of camels. You step on sand, you'll sink. So a lot of desert species, if they're bigger, they need to have a really wide base to stop themselves from sinking into the sand.
That would also help with the way it moves towards the Rodian? Rodian, was it?
Yeah, Rodian.
Yeah, the way that it moves towards the Rodian, it's got four legs on the ground and is kind of rearing up on its front two. But I think it would probably be better off most of the time having all six legs on the ground to disperse the weight even more, right?
Yeah, I agree. The way that it seems to start sort of moving in that direction. Other adaptations, so the thick, hairy coats that we see on the Bantas, or Banthas, that's a desert adaptation we see for protecting yourself from the excessive heat that you run into.
And the excessive cold that you run into at nighttime as well.
Yep.
This is one thing we forgot to say last week, that in a desert at nighttime, Vin Diesel would have died of hypothermia very, very quickly in a tank top.
Yep.
Yeah, as Adam could have attested to if he was here.
I also really love, and we talked about this briefly, the thickened mouth. Like, you get to see the lips around this lizard are really tough. It's got quite a set of teeth in terms of everything looks quite sharp. Our species have to adapt to chew on cactus, a process that I would not wish on anyone. So, you got to toughen up if you're going to live there. Some other cool little adaptations before I get to my favorites, because I hadn't realized. The Dorcas gazelle, if they are in a situation in which they cannot get enough water, these gazelle can concentrate their urine into uric acid, something we normally just see within birds. And then when they finally have to pee, they basically just release a white pellet. So, like, they just have a solid chunk of material that falls out of them, and they're like, I just peed. And it's like, that's...
Yep.
Cool.
A lot of birds and reptiles, that's why bird shit is bird pee.
Yeah.
Like, they just combine it all into one.
Yeah.
And if you're trying to keep in as much fluid as possible, you don't want to be peeing out a bunch of fluid.
Roadrunners have a unique adaptation where when they're in situations that they're running low, they can actually secrete excess salt that they run into through their eyes.
Mm.
So they will cry salt.
Okay.
How does that do
protecting them against coyotes?
I mean, I guess you're just seasoning yourself, so maybe that's why the coyote's after the Roadrunner at all times. He's just like, yes.
Yeah.
And then the last was the Sidewinder. So Sidewinders, the snake, has a really abnormal presentation when they're kind of moving across the sand. I had never realized that the way that they take on that formation is so that they only have a maximum of 2 points of their body touching the hot sand at a time. Okay. Which allows them to better protect their bodies, which is why they have that really abnormal movement. Now,
right, okay.
Top point of, man, nature is cool, and I want to interpret this with not only is nature cool, but nature is really cool when we start to use it for various things. Sam, do you understand how camel noses work and why they're so cool?
No, I don't. I've never been focused on the camel nose. I've just been focused on whatever disgusting fucking things they've been doing with their mouths.
So when
camels are gross, vicious assholes.
When camels breathe out, camels actually exhale air that is significantly cooler than their body temperature. This is not something that's seen within most other animal species. So in 19...
Both camel species?
I don't know if it's true for both. Oh, yeah. No, you're right. It looks like both species of desert-dwelling camel do exist in a state where they perform this trick. So usually humans, we breathe out air at the same temperature as the rest of our body. Camels do not. And this was a big discussion up until 1979 when they figured out why this was the case. So camels use two different parts of physics to help protect themselves. So they use an increase in surface area, and they use the fact that cooler air holds less moisture. So if you're in the desert, there's two different things you need. You need to stay cool, and you need to get water in. And one of the adaptations that camels have come up with is that they have an intricate labyrinth of air passageways that are present in camel's nose, which increases the surface area many fold over a straight nasal pathway. So for a human nose, we only have 2 square inches of interior surface area. The camel, on the other hand, has 155 square inches of mucous membrane nasal interior that air has to pass through. So their nose basically acts as both a humidifier and a dehumidifier with every breathing cycle. Here's where it gets important. Hot, dry air is inhaled over this 155 square inches of moist membrane. The air is immediately humidified. It picks up moisture from the surrounding nose, and in this process, it's cooled. When hot air picks up water, it cools down quite a bit. So this is physics area one. So this air, cool air then passes into the lungs and remains approximately there. It helps to cool down the organism. And then when the air is exhaled, this cool air is passed over those same mucous membranes. But this time, the cool air actually holds less moisture, so on its way out, it ends up leaving its moisture behind inside of the camel, breathing out a cooler air.
So they're creating water just out of thin air.
They're cooling themselves and creating water.
Fucking hell.
So this structure is now trying to be incorporated by a number of different engineers into desert buildings because they think it might be a more environmentally sustainable method to bring air in through a series of different pathways. If you just have to bring it in with a fan that have moisture present, it will cool the buildings, and then on its way out, all of the moisture plus some extra gets left behind before the air ends up leaving the building.
One more thing, the advanced kind of nasal structures, that is another feature that they believe the synapse had started to develop, particularly the desert-dwelling ones.
Cool. And then last point I wanted to throw in just for Sam, because it's the thorny devil from the Australian outback. They obviously have a lot of problems running into pooled water.
If you haven't seen what a thorny devil is, the thorny devil is basically, it's just, looks like a gecko if you just covered it with spikes.
And I had never understood what those spikes are for. So aside from protection, to deal with the issue, the thorny devil has developed skin that can absorb water like blotter paper. So the scales on the body are structured in such a way that it collects dew and then it channels it down to the corners of its mouth, where the lizard drinks. So if you've ever seen them, you can actually watch the lizard's skin darken as it soaks up water. And then you can watch them sit and they'll like lick. But they've basically got like one of those stadium hats that people go to that they throw beers on the top of and they've got the little tubes down. Except these guys are doing it in a far less alcoholic fashion.
Nice. I know there are some other species that absorb a lot of moisture through the skin directly.
Yeah.
And then they've created problems before for pet owners who will try to, you know, give them water to drink. And they'll start to desiccate. And then you'll just spray them with water and they'll be fine.
Yep.
I don't look a day over 2,000. Moisturize me. Moisturize me.
So we've talked a lot at this point about how desert organisms work. But one thing, and we've spoken about this a lot before, is that you can't have an entire planet that's just one ecosystem. No. Well, you shouldn't have an entire planet that's one ecosystem. It's silly. Dagobah being an entirely swampy planet, just nonsense, okay? But you can sort of create an Earth-like planet that has a larger percentage of desert than normal.
Yeah.
So, I don't think if you wanted to sustain regular life, you would be able to have this much land on a planet. However, before we get into the biogeography, I just want to touch on a little bit of Star Wars history, which, as Dave's just told me, is actually referenced in episode 2 and 3. That Tatooine wasn't always a desert planet. It used to have lots of tropical jungles and a lot of ocean as well. So what happened was that an invading species came in, took over, was thrown out after a rebellion by the locals, and did some sort of bombing of the surface, which fused all the silica, the heavy silica in the soil, into glass. Glass which over time eroded into sand. And the oceans were boiled away as well, which is how we got to a planet which apparently has less than 1% of its surface area covered by water. So, what we have here is, if it was, again, a planet that was covered in tropical jungles, then I don't know how you have all these desert-dwelling species. Potentially, they were brought in by colonizing forces later on. But, putting that sort of stuff aside, what you could get is a massive continent that was largely located in a temperate zone. And that's when a lot of the synapsids I was talking about earlier kind of flourished, when a supercontinent was formed on the planet Earth, and the inland areas further away from the coast had massive amounts of arid land, which, created these super large deserts. So you've got one massive continent. If anybody hasn't caught on at this point, I'm kind of talking about Australia. So, if you had Australia, but much larger, you could get to this kind of perception of a planet as being covered in desert. However, that then begs the question, why the fuck isn't everybody just living on the coastline? Now, this is when we start to get a little further out of my wheelhouse. I have to know some of this when I taught biogeography for master's students. But, if you had faster winds, that potentially creates more volatile coastal weather and makes living on the coast untenable. So you have to move further away from the coast towards the desert. And you have to be living in an area that looks terrible, like most of Tatooine does, but is preferable to these massive, enormous coastal storms that are wrecking the coast on a constant basis. Again, we're getting into planetary orbit stuff as well, but it would also help if the angle of the planet to the sun was reduced compared to ours. So we get seasons and we have seasonality on the planet Earth, particularly the further you get towards the poles, because the Earth's axis of orbit is tilted compared to the sun's, right? In December and January, the Earth is at its quote-unquote highest point, where the northern hemisphere is for large parts of the day tilted away from the sun at an angle of about 23 degrees. Which is why it's so fucking cold up here, because the sun just doesn't shine as much on this part of the globe. As our orbit around the sun continues, that 23 degree angle is consistent, but as you get towards June, the sun is now shining more on the northern hemisphere, which is why we get summer, right? If that angle is reduced, you get much more consistent temperatures, and you also get the likelihood of a lot more desert and a lot less variability over the course of the year. So you could potentially have much larger continents that are still covered by desert. And again, this is starting to get further and further away from my level of comfort, my wheelhouse. But I think if you had a larger, faster orbiting planet with potentially a lower tilt, then you could get enormous continents that are just covered by deserts. If anybody else is a proper astronomer, as opposed to an astronomist, which I said last week for some reason, and has thoughts on this, I would love to hear you chime in to let me know if my amateur astronomy / biogeography makes any sense whatsoever. But yeah, I mean, I guess you could potentially get enormous continents filled by desert where nobody's living in the coast because the weather is just so fucking disgustingly awful all the time.
As well as, I mean, I like that idea of chemical modification secondary to war. It's not like yep. we used agents that defoliated and ended up doing tons of damage during American conflicts. Agent Orange is fucking awful. And it's not like humanity is currently turning areas of our planet into a desert right now.
Yeah, exactly. Desertification is a massive problem. I've talked about it earlier in this season. And I think that is a more likely reason. For what we see here. It's just, yeah, human interference has turned this planet into a wasteland. Post-climate change apocalypse.
You recall what you said about how polar melting might disrupt the North Atlantic current?
Yes.
Well, I think it's happening.
Cool, so, finishing up this week then, we don't have a story pit because Libby's not here this week, but we will have some more at the end of the season of The Book of Boba Fett when we come back and touch on this again with Adam and Libby. But do we feel bad for the monsters we see this week?
I mean, the dog, seems like it's doing fine. But yeah. the lizard creature, if in fact everything that you're talking about is true, I mean, I feel bad that the environment has potentially been drastically shifted and changed around these organisms, forcing them to potentially alter a lot of their physiology or ecology over a short period of time. Do I feel bad specifically for this one? 50-50. I love that he killed that Rodian. That was a great stomp. But at the same time, he was trying to chomp down on everybody.
I think he was just scared.
Yeah.
I thought maybe he thought he was being attacked, and he was being attacked.
You're right. They did wake him up. They dug him up.
They dug him up, they gave him a prod, and then, you know, when he reacted badly and grabbed the first thing he saw, they, you know, they went right in for him. Poor Boba Fett was unfortunately chained to...
to the Rodian.
To the Rodian, so, you know, he didn't have much choice, but... Also, he gets thumped in that scene.
A lot. Like,
he gets hit really hard. Yeah.
And he gets thumped all the way through this show. That is the most common part, is just Boba takes a beating.
Back to the back to town.
Yeah, Boba Boo-Boos.
Boba Boo-Boos. Boba Fett. Doesn't have a ring to it. No. Would we recommend this series based on the first couple of episodes?
Yeah. I'm really enjoying it.
I think I would as well, purely for the aesthetic. Again, it really feels like, you know, your granddaddy's Star Wars.
Again, I love a show that is not all super organized with plans within plans. It's just a guy trying to, like, make things work as he goes along and trying to act super confident about it.
Just muddling
by. He really does. You haven't got to a scene. There is a scene coming up where, not to spoil too much, but a Wookiee pulls him out of the back to tank and just beats the shit out of him. It's a great scene. It's a fantastic scene.
Nice. Next week, we are coming back for a doubleheader. Greek mythology's best representation on screen. I say that somewhat sarcastically. With the cloth / rash of the Titans.
Rash of the Titans is great. I'm just picturing creatures just scratching incessantly the entire time.
Yeah, so we'll be back with that next week. Hopefully with Libby and Lidum and Abby. Fuck's sake. Hopefully with Libby and Adam intact. And returned to us by the Israeli emergency services once again.
Yep.
And in the meantime, as we say at the end of every episode, the monsters aren't real, but the science is.
Bye, guys.
Bye-bye.
I am not a bounty hunter. I've heard otherwise.